This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of The Progressive Magazine. Welcome to Progressive Radio. Today we're going to be talking about African-American history and art and the history of white people. With me to discuss all this is Nell Painter, author most recently of Creating Black Americans. Nell Painter is the author of several other books, including a highly acclaimed biography of Sojourner Truth. She recently retired from her post as a longtime professor of history at Princeton. She's been selected by her peers to be president of the Southern Historical Association in 2007 and president of the Organization of American Historians in 2008. Nell Painter, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
I always like to get a sense of the person at the beginning, so why don't you clue me in as to why you decided to become a history professor?
Matt, I don't know. I love history, I can tell you that. I love the doing, I love the research. In fact, just a few days ago, I was in the Princeton University Library sitting over a microfilm reader reading issues of the Saturday Evening Post from 1921 and 1922. That's the kind of thing I love to do.
And what were you exploring there?
Immigration restriction.
Well, very timely topic, I have to say.
It really is. And you hear the same things over and over again.
How ugly was it back then in those
It was clips? Uglier than it is now, actually.
Mm-hmm. And do you think people have gotten over it, or they just mask it better now?
Well, it comes and goes, depending on how many immigrants there are who's playing up to fears and getting people riled up and so forth. So the interplay between political opportunism and numbers of immigrants varies from time to time.
And correct me if I'm wrong, the immigrant wave at that time was Eastern European Jewish a lot.
Yeah. The three people whom the restrictionist always targeted were Slavs from the former Austro-Hungarian Empire, Southern Italians, somehow they didn't mind Northern Italians, and Jews from Poland and Russia. There were lots of other people coming, like lots of Germans and Scandinavians and Irish, but they didn't attract the negative attention. And at that time, the whole discussion was racialized in a way that it's not now and hadn't been in the 19th century.
Though it's racialized to some extent these days against Mexicans who want to come in the
United States. It's not, I mean, literally racialized in the sense that these people are racist. So, for instance, the saying now is that Latinos can be of any racial background. And that's, I think, that kind of classification is very much in flux. But at the turn of the 20th century, that was when people really believed in race, whether they were racialized themselves or they were the racializers. Science was on the side of race at that point.
Crude science at that.
Yeah, well, this was the best and the brightest. These were people from Harvard. And they kept saying that there really is such a thing as race, and we can measure it, and there are three races of Europe, and we can tell by the shapes of their heads.
And the size of their brains and all that
stuff. No, the shapes of their
heads. Just the shapes of the heads.
Yeah, the brains come later. I mean, the people talking about brains is later.
It is amazing what you focus, what scientists focus on,
yes.
What the
yes.
public focuses
yes.
on,
yes.
and how recent enlightenment is, and maybe how in flux, to
Actually,
use your term,
Actually, you know,
it is.
It's not so much how recent enlightenment is that strikes me, but how recent the really vicious racist characterization, when that really starts biting in terms of policy. Because I pick up on it in my research around 1891, 1899, around, but it's after the First World War that it really gets nasty. And between 1899 and 1924 is a generation.
Recent always. In hindsight, looking back, I mean, how recent lynchings were and how crude they were. You
yeah.
talk about this in your book. With
I say
being
we
a
don't
spectacle.
Know when the last lynching has occurred.
And you mention also, you know, people carrying passengers on trains to see the lynchings as a kind of celebration. And there is a piece of artwork in this book, Nell Painter, Creating Black Americans, of an artist saying, essentially, and you'll have to tell me exactly what he said or she said.
She said.
Yeah, about how could you take this picture
of yes.
a photographer.
Yes, took
this
that's
picture.
One of my favorite pieces.
Tell me about that.
Williams. what's her first name? In the first, can you find it?
I'll look for it, yeah.
It's a collage, and around the outside is writing, and in the middle are three pieces of photographs from Life magazine of a man who has been blowtorched and lynched. And the art, yeah, there it is. Good. Thank you very much.
I'm speaking with Nell Painter. She's the author of Creating Black Americans, and part of this sensational book is the inclusion of artists' work. And this one that we're talking about is about a photographer who took a picture of a lynching.
Yeah. The piece of artwork is Accused Blowtorch Padlock from 1986 by Pat Ward Williams, who is herself a photographer, but this is not her own photography. And in the center, there are four pieces, I'm sorry, of this lynching of this man who was tortured by a blowtorch. You don't see his head, and you don't see much past his waistline, but you can see that it's a gruesome image. And it's Williams's words that really strike you. She says, "There's something going on here. I didn't understand it right away. I just saw that he looked so helpless. He didn't look tortured. He didn't look lynched. What is that? How long has he been locked to that tree? Can you be black and look at this without fear?" Life magazine published this photo. Could Hitler show pics of the Holocaust to keep the Jews in line? Who took this picture? Couldn't he just as easily let the man go? Did he take his camera home and bring back a blowtorch? And where do you torture someone with a blowtorch? Burn off an ear? Melt an eye or scorch a mouth? Oh, God, who took this picture? How can this photograph exist? Life answers, page 141, no credit. Somebody do something.
It is an incredibly powerful piece of work. I'm speaking with Nell Painter, who was just reading from Creating Black Americans. It raises the philosophical question as to how can human beings do this kind of thing? And this isn't exclusively a discussion of slavery or of lynchings, but of atrocities, as the artist suggests with the Holocaust. Do you have an answer to that one?
No.
I wish you did.
No, I don't. I know I don't. But one thing we know from just the times we've lived in the last decade or so, things going on right around us, is that people do unimaginable things to other people, to their neighbors, to their friends. And it's not a racial thing or an ethnic thing, that this happens when the rule of law breaks down.
Well, it's not just Rwanda. It's Bosnia. It's
yeah.
Cambodia.
Yeah.
I mean, it's wherever we look. It's going on in Baghdad right now.
And one of the things I say sometimes when people ask me about the slave trade, I say, well, and they try to make it into something specifically African. And I say, no, there have been lots of other slave trades. And actually, the name Caucasian for white people comes out of the tradition of the white slave trade from the Caucasus and Georgia and the Balkans.
I didn't know that.
Yes, yes. I can tell you more about that in a moment. But the point is that during the Balkan Wars of the 1980s and 1990s, if there had been some enterprising merchant with ships in the Adriatic, you would have seen another slave trade because the situation was ripe for it.
You write in this book that the African slave trade wasn't depicted in art by African Americans here in the United States until the 20s or 30s, the 1920s and 30s.
Yeah.
Why is that?
Even later than that. I think because it has been and still is such a difficult subject to face, because Americans often phrase it as they sold their own people, which seems unthinkable. in the times we live in, of course, we see that kind of thing happening all the time. But certainly the idea of they sold their own people is something scary. So otherwise, you know, if you don't know a little more about the slave trade, it's something to shy away from. If you know some more about it and you realize that it was a business like many other nasty businesses in this world, you can depict it. And over again in the recent past, black artists have been depicting the slave trade.
And you've got some amazing representations in here. You have John Bigger's Middle Passage that I'm looking at right now, which looks it has a lot of hands, dangling hands, clutching hands to the bars, the wooden bars that the slaves are being held in on the in the passage over. And you also have one by Bearden, and then a really astonishing one by Faith Ringgold, We Came to America, that depicts this the Statue of Liberty as a black woman holding a baby, but there's smoke coming out of the out of the statue, and that smoke mingles with the smoke coming out of the
burning
the,
slave
the ship,
yeah.
And the sea is just filled with drowning slaves.
Yeah, but I think there's more going on there. I think also because that is so clearly the Bay of New York, and that because Ringgold works on several layers and meaning at a time, they may also be people who are at the beach.
I hadn't thought of it that way. Why the emphasis on visual art? When I picked up this book, when I read that you'd done this book, I was expecting a scholarly book, just a plain old non-visual linear scholarly book about the history of African Americans.
Yes.
And lo and behold, I opened this book to a – well, it is that. There is that history. But this is just an intensely rich, visual, stunning could be a coffee table book of African American
art. Some people
have
bought it as a coffee table book, actually.
There's nothing wrong with
that.
I
hope they read it at some point as well. But it is very beautiful. And much of the credit goes to the designer, a woman named Susan Day in Chicago, who did a fabulous job designing that book.
Yeah, I mean, the four color artwork, very different kinds of art represented here, though not a lot of abstract art.
Well, there was a little abstract art in the first draft, but then the question from early readers was, how are we going to explain this? And I realized that I would have to explain it. And then there was the tug of war between the number of words. So am I going to use my words explaining abstract art, or am I going to use my words telling what happened?
And do you have a background in art history, or did you?
No, I'm self-taught.
And is this a recent interest, or have you long been interested in?
That depends on who you ask. If you ask my husband, he says, no, no, it's a long-standing interest. If you ask me, I say it was only just yesterday. But Sojourner Truth was the one who really got me into what Roland Barthes called the rhetoric of the image.
And how did that happen?
Sojourner Truth, the feminist abolitionist, ex-New York slave speaker, did not read or write. So as a biographer, I wanted to try to figure out a way to somehow get to what she thought of herself, how she wanted us to see her or understand her meaning. And one thing she did control was sittings for photographic portraits. So I sat down with those photographic portraits and a wonderful art history library at Princeton University and read and read and read and learned a little something about photography and visual meaning.
I'm Matt Rothschild. You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm speaking with Nell Painter, author most recently of Creating Black Americans, Sojourner Truth. There is a depiction of a piece of artwork.
There are two. There are two. And when I talk about this book, I usually talk with visuals, and I give my audience a choice of which depictions of Sojourner Truth they prefer as history. Several of them are Sojourner Truth's carte de visite, that is the photographic portrait Sojourner Truth herself sat for and arranged for. And the others are the two images by 20th century artists in Creating Black Americans.
And what are those images?
They're both sculpture, interestingly enough. One is by Inga Hardison from 1968. I think I've got that date right. It's the sculpture that Mario Cuomo gave to Nelson Mandela when Mandela visited New York. And it's a sort of sweeping, upright figure, very drawn, full up. The other, by Barbara Chase Ribou, from, I think, 96, is a model for a monument, for a Sojourner Truth monument. And that is an equestrian statue, though Sojourner Truth is not on as a horse. She's by a horse, so she's kind of a seeker. But it's Barbara Chase Ribou is very much trained in the European academic tradition. So this is an equestrian statue that you might recognize from a square in an American city or in a European city. So they're very different from what Sojourner Truth showed. They're much more heroic, for one thing. So sometimes people say they like the Sojourner Truth photographs because that's more true, in the sense that that's what Sojourner Truth produced. Others say they prefer the more modern, the more recent depictions because they're more heroic.
Speaking of heroic equestrian depictions, I was struck by the one of Colin Powell on a
horse
and Robert E. Lee on a horse.
Yes, that is a painting. I think it's from 1998 by a painter named John Jones in South Carolina, who specializes – he's the only artist I know, the only black artist I know, who specializes in Civil War depictions. And this is a work of art that – could only be a work of art. It's a narrative, an imagined narrative. It has these two figures together. It's a big painting. And in the background is Robert E. Lee looking just a little anxious. Robert E. Lee is on a black horse. And in the foreground, looking quite prepossessed and full of confidence and not looking at Robert E. Lee, in his own uniform, is Colin Powell, and he's on the white horse. So I used to ask my students, and I asked my audiences, what's going on in this picture, and what would have happened if this really could have been? So this is a counterfactual. It's the kind of thing historians hate, but it's the kind of things that artists can do.
I mentioned Colin Powell also for another reason, because you talk about him at the end of your book. You talk about black conservatives, and you talk about blacks who've served in the Bush administration, Powell, Condoleezza Rice, as a way of discussing the varieties within the African-American community. Also, you talk about class divisions, and you quote some observers who say we're moving into what they call a post-black era.
Yeah.
Do you agree with that description?
No. I think there will always be black. You might say that black-white is in the racial DNA, or the DNA, period, of the United States, that the distinction between black and white, whoever fills those categories, but the distinction and the existence of those categories is absolutely fundamental to our American culture. So we'll always have black people. We'll always have poor black people whom we'll call the underclass or on the lowdown or ghetto or, you know, whatever it is. That has to be a backdrop against which we understand white. I'm saying that we are now in the third large enlargement of whiteness, meaning Americans. Americans are white people for, you know, it's a sort of common sense, the Gramscian common sense way of
thinking.
Did
all Americans, is that what you're suggesting?
Well, Americans are white people.
Mm-hmm.
And to be an American is to be a white person. And the opposite of that is to be a poor black person. Mm. So obviously there are lots of other people who don't fit into those two categories. So we shoehorn people into them. The categories, I'm saying, are perpetual. Who we shoehorn in and why and how changes.
And who we label racially that way.
Yeah. Well, part of being white now is not being not being labeled and not being marked. So we only have one marked category.
Because the others assume normative. Is that what you're saying? You know, some of the, you also have charts in here that are quite amazing, and you were talking about poor blacks. I was struck by the chart from 1934 about the percentage of unemployed black men. It was between 40% and 60% in major metropolitan areas. The thing that struck me wasn't that statistic, but the fact that that statistic is still true. Today, in a lot of metropolitan cities, the percentage of unemployed black men is in the 40s and 50s. In Milwaukee, it's 55%.
Oh, la, la. Well, I think I'm disagreeing with you here because before deindustrialization, certainly the black participation in the workforce, including for men, is much higher than for others. After deindustrialization, then you have soaring unemployment.
Which is what we have now, yes. Yeah. Tell me about this. Let's get back to whiteness. You are writing, I read anyway, or heard anyway,
yes.
A history of whiteness.
Yes.
Or a history of white America.
History of white people. A history of white people, yeah. It's true. It is an American history. But it starts much more broadly because so many of our ideas about whiteness are European ideas, notably German ideas. And in the 19th and early 20th centuries, educated white Americans who were producing the knowledge about white identity looked either to German scholars or British scholars, and British scholars in turn looked to German scholars.
And how far back does that go, the beginning of this white superiority? Or how far back are you tracing it anyway?
Well, in the United States, it goes back at least to the Constitution. Or to 1790, to naturalization. And the only people who can be naturalized are free and white. Very often people forget about the free part and think, oh, yeah, if you're white, you're free. Well, that was not true in 1790. But you had to be both white and free to be naturalized.
But the founders must have gotten that idea from somewhere. So I'm wondering where, you know, how far back that this idea
in the United States.
Yeah, in the
yes,
United
it go, it would go back to it would go back to before there was a United States,
right.
Because it's the Atlantic slave trade that does it. However, okay, it's the Atlantic slave trade that makes black people slaves, and with the
to justify the slave trade, is that right, or is it
to justify slavery?
Right.
Yeah. But somebody like Ralph Waldo Emerson, writing in the middle of the 19th century, has this idea, which was very common at the time, that whiteness means freedom. But this is not.
It's interesting because Emerson is viewed as an abolitionist with Thoreau and Garrison and those people, right?
I just – last year I wrote a huge chapter, which will have to somehow get smaller, on Emerson as the founding father of American white race theory.
Hmm.
Emerson.
How blatant was it?
It was pretty blatant. The book is called English Traits, published in 1856. And most people don't even know the existence of this book.
How'd you stumble on it?
How did I stumble on it? I probably stumbled on it. Well, I have a friend who has written Neil Baldwin has written a book on ideas that inspired Americans, and he has a chapter on Emerson. And there's also a book by a man named Nikoloff called, well, I'm not getting the title right, but it's Emerson's Ideas on Race, and he mentions English Traits. Because, you know, I'm not a scholar of literature, and I certainly am not, you know, my knowledge of Emerson before this was really very, very thin. Now I have actually read many of Emerson's journals, and I've read English Traits and Fate. You know, just I've read a lot
of
Emerson.
And so does it permeate a lot of his work?
Well, one idea is that that Saxons, and he sees English people as Saxons and New Englanders who are Americans as Saxons. And one fundamental idea is freedom. Well, it turns – you know, I did a little history here, and it turns out that his Saxons – this is cockamamie history, stupid, silly, weird history that Emerson retails with a straight face – So the Saxons of Britain, of England, have ancestors who are Vikings. Vikings were the world's preeminent slavers in their time.
It is amazing when and disillusioning when we find out about these people. I have a colleague who is from India, and I was saying how much I like John Stuart Mill. He said, "Didn't you know John Stuart Mill was a racist about Indians?" And I hadn't noted.
Well, you know, one thing I find absolutely fascinating is I've had to go back to sort of Western civilization texts and things like that. And they talk about the great ideas of Western civilization. They never mention race. Who invented it? Western civilization.
We only have a couple minutes left, Nell Painter. How do we get beyond these conceptions of whiteness, the idea that white is the normative color in America?
Well, I'll say something that's perfectly hackneyed for a former professor, and that is knowledge. Start by knowing something.
Do you miss teaching, by the way?
No.
Well, why is that? most would at least feign, I guess.
I get to talk to people like you. And when I go around giving lectures, I get to talk to people. So my talking quotient is still okay. And I'm also writing now. So those are the things that I don't miss ordering books. You know, that sort of thing. I don't miss having to turn up at a certain time to talk to people all the time. And then in the fall, I'm going back to school full time. So I will be an undergraduate.
What are you going to be studying?
Visual art.
No kidding.
Mason Gross School of the Arts at Rutgers University in New Jersey.
And are you going to be making art too, or just studying it?
Yes.
Painting?
Well, I'll start with painting because that's what I've been doing. But one reason I want to do a Bachelor of Fine Arts is just to roll around in the other media.
Wow, that's terrific.
I'm going to be an undergraduate again.
So you're looking forward to it. It sure sounds like.
I really am.
Tell me about you write just briefly. We only have a minute left. You write briefly about music and hip-hop, rap, and you give a defense of it that I was surprised by, too.
Well, it's not an all-out defense, for heaven's sakes. I had to. This is 30 years old now. So it's historical, and so I had to do my duty as a historian.
You're big on commemorations, too.
Yes.
You think it's very important for African Americans to commemorate.
It's important for everybody. History and memory is one of my fields. And
why is that so important?
Because what we commemorate tells us who we think we are, and commemorations make us visible.
And we can choose that way.
Well, it depends if we have a say in what gets commemorated and what goes on the street corner and so forth. So my husband and I spent spring in Berlin, which is a place we wanted to go, because the issues of commemoration are so fraught and so easy to see in Germany.
How can people get hold of this book, Creating Black Americans?
Well, probably the simplest way is through Amazon.com. I would recommend they buy it from Oxford University Press, though, because it costs more.
There you go. We're out of time. Nell Painter, it's been a real pleasure
speaking
with you, and good luck with visual arts as an undergraduate.
Yes.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.